Welcome to another Crime Cast by Revamp. This is one of our special episodes that we have titled Stories from the Past. Now, this is a story that I did a YouTube video on back about 10 or 12 years ago, and it's had thousands of views. A lot of people in Fort Smith asked me about this story, so we decided to do a Crime Cast on it. And it's a really heartbreaking story. And it took place right here in Fort Smith, Arkansas. And I never passed the Immaculate Conception Church that I don't think about what Bobby Joe did there at the church in one of his last acts. It was in January of 1958. The top-selling single was At the Hop by Danny and the Juniors, but coming along close behind was Elvis Presley's I Beg of You. And the song became number one by February of 1958. Elvis would be arriving in Fort Smith in just a couple of months, and it was going to be a big event for Fort Smith. And to this day, you could still drive by and see the barber shop at Fort Chaffee, where Elvis had his famous military haircut after joining the Army. Fort Smith started out the year with an event, though, that was quite the opposite of Elvis arriving. Fort Smith was shocked by a sequence of events that unfolded in the public's eye by a young man who was terribly disturbed and committed a crime that shocked the community and still shocks the community in comparison to so many of the tragic events that unfold daily across Fort Smith, Arkansas, or even the United States. Bobby Joe Burns was born on August the 8th, 1929, to Jesse and Edna Burns, and by all accounts, he was a happy child. But if that were true, something had gone terribly wrong along the way. Bobby Joe Burns lived on South L Street, just off Dodson Avenue, with his mother, Edna Burns. The house still sits at the location today. Bobby was in his late 20s, and he should have been carving a niche in his life, but Bobby was tormented beyond what most of us can even imagine. Bobby had piercing eyes, dark hair, and somewhat of a receding hairline for a 28-year-old, but he wore his hair slicked back, with one loose lock hanging over his forehead. The style was pretty much in step with the fashions of the 50s. Bobby had dark eyes with prominent arching eyebrows and deep dimples in his cheeks. Most people in the downtown area of Fort Smith was in some way familiar with Bobby upon sight, but few really knew the true Bobby Joe Burns. When I first heard the story, it was told to me by Mayor Ray Baker some years ago, and several people that were in my Rotary Club also remembered the story, and they told me how it really shook the community and it changed things in Fort Smith. Before that time, many families did not lock their doors. Many families did not fear of murder happening in their neighborhood or in their town. And everybody that was living in Fort Smith at the time that this happened can still to this day tell you where they were and what they were doing when they heard the word. When I first heard the story, it had quite a twist, and it fascinated me from the very first mention. It was told to me that they recalled that Bobby Joe Burns would walk to and from work, and on one particular day, which he was working for an attorney that, or had an office right off of Garrison Avenue, so he would walk from L Street up towards Towson and over towards Garrison. I don't know that it was an everyday job, but it was on a regular basis. And on one particular day, he was walking towards the attorney's office, and he ran across a young woman about the same age. Bobby was quite taken by this young woman and her kindness, and so they began exchanging words and conversation. And over a period of time, Bobby decided to take their friendship to a deeper level by asking her out on a date. Bobby appeared to have an unusual relationship with his mother, and some would say that it was very uncommonly close. So whether this was actually the case or not, it was never proven. But Bobby had gone home and told his mother that he had plans to ask this young woman out on a date. Now, for whatever the reason, whether Edna felt threatened by the idea of him having a relationship with another woman, or maybe it was because she was concerned about his mental illness, whatever the reason, Edna tried to discourage it. Maybe Edna was just aware of how dangerous her son could be and didn't want another person exposed to his mental issues or his potential dangerous actions. On September the 13th, 1951, Bobby had been arrested for grand larceny and burglary for breaking into Dr. A.A. Martin's car. Bobby had taken narcotics and medical supplies from the auto. And then in 1953, Bobby was once again charged with breaking into a doctor's automobile, But this time it was Dr. Art Martin's car and was parked at 2121 Wolf Lane. Once again, Bobby had stolen narcotics, syringes, and other medical supplies and was charged for a second time with grand larceny and burglary. But after each arrest, Bobby was sent to Little Rock to the state hospital. But after 30 days, his mother, Edna, would convince the doctors to release him into her care. The doctors were very reluctant, but they did so after they went through great lengths to try to persuade her to let him stay at the hospital. I'm not sure if Edna could have been aware of how deep his mental illness affected his thoughts, or even what actions that Bobby was capable of carrying out, because she took full responsibility for checking him out of the state mental hospital. Being the mother of four children, I find it hard to imagine being in the position that Edna Burns was in, as it would be heartbreaking for any mother to walk away and leave a son at any age in a state hospital in 1950, even more so then than it is today. According to eNotes Online, an online database, it said that in 1950, one in three American families would have to admit a family member to a mental institution, and by 1959, some 800,000 Americans were institutionalized. Now keep in mind, there were only 4,700 licensed psychiatrists. They also reported that only about 500 new psychiatrists were being trained each year. At the time that mental illness affected 16% more people than cancer, yet cancer received 400% more research money than did mental illness. Due to those statistics, most institutions were overcrowded. They lacked facilities, they lacked training or resources to treat their patients, and most of them became something of a warehouse just to hold society's misfits. Only in the mid-1950s did the first psychiatric medication become widely used. It's commonly known as Thorazine, and it was one of the leading drugs, and it was used to treat schizophrenia and manic depression. I suppose they thought it was a huge breakthrough that replaced the common practice of frontal lobotomy, and shock treatment were common forms of treatment for mental illness in those cases that actually did receive any treatment. In the 1950s, an admission into the mental hospital was usually a sentence to death, and most would spend the rest of their life locked away out of the society's sight. Edna Burns was probably aware of these facts, and after all, this was her son, her flesh and her blood, and what mother could walk away from a child under those type of circumstances? There isn't much that the public really knew about Bobby and Edna's life between the last crime and the state hospital visit until the fateful morning of 1958, but it must have been a very stressful and difficult period for Edna, as Bobby's bizarre behavior must have been escalating. And on this particular day, Edna must have tried to help Bobby by referring him to Bible verses, and Edna must have felt that God was more able to help Bobby than any state hospital. Bobby was given medications by the state, and he took them as he saw fit, not as the doctors had prescribed. It was thought that Bobby and Edna began arguing about the situation the night before she was murdered. Bobby gave Edna the drugs, and she was under his control that day. It was unknown how he got the drugs in her body, whether it was by force or deception. Once Bobby had his mother under his control, he decapitated her, he removed her tongue, her nose, and at least one eye. He boiled them on the stove in the kitchen. He dismembered her body, and then he wrapped her head in a sheet and went out the door and on his way. Bobby walked from South L Street to Garrison Avenue, carrying the head of his mother, until he reached the Immaculate Conception Church at the very end of Garrison Avenue. Once he reached the church, he placed her head in the vestibule of the church, and he left it there. He left the church, he walked down Garrison Avenue, he crossed the bridge over into Oklahoma, and Bobby spent the rest of the night in the Moffett Bottoms, where the police located him the following morning. It was quite cold that night, even spitting some small flakes of snow, and it began misting rain. Bobby was wearing only a pair of jeans and a white short-sleeved t-shirt. He was found sleeping in one of the fields on the west side of the Moffett Bottoms. Bobby was taken into the Fort Smith Police Department for interrogation, where he confessed to the murder. I get the feeling that Bobby Joe was somehow seeking answers, but what were the questions in his mind? Bobby stated that it was under the direction of God that he took the life of his mother, and he referenced the book of Revelations 20, verse 9 through 11. I've never seen or heard what edition of the Bible Bobby was reading or what he happened to have handy that day, but I assume for just the story that it was the King James Version. Now I looked those Bible verses up, and here's what they say. Verse 9, "And they went up on the breadth of the earth and compassed the camp of the saints about and beloved city, and fire came down from God out of heaven and devoured them." Verse 10, "And the devil that deceived them was cast into the lake of fire and brimstone, where the beast and the false prophets are, and shall be tormented day and night forever and ever." Verse 11, "And I saw a great white throne, and from him that sat on it, from those who faced the earth and the heavens fled away, and there was found no place for them." Now, I have no idea how Bobby Joe got these messages from these verses, and that's what he stated to police when he confessed. The only correlation I see is there are in those words, "were tormented day and night forever and ever." I would say that must have described Bobby Joe Burns better than anything that I can think up. Bobby's mother, Edna, must have been a very devoted mother. When she checked him out of the state mental hospital and agreed to care for him in the home, it had to be a daunting task for anyone. And Bobby had been prescribed medications for paranoid schizophrenia, but was said to abuse the medication, according to the stories published by the Southwest American News at the time. The story doesn't elaborate on how he abused them, either by taking more than he was prescribed or less, but he was skipping doses, and obviously it did not keep his delusions at bay. Bobby Joe Burns' brother came to visit him in the jail, and it was said that he told his brother, quote, "Joe, we don't blame you for what happened," end quote. His brother brought him 2 packs of cigarettes and then left, never to visit again. There was a photo that appeared in the Southwest American newspaper just 2 days after Bobby's arrest. You can see that on our website. I just can't even describe it. Bobby was taken back to Little Rock for evaluation and within days of his arrest, but as he had with the 2 previous admittances to the state hospital, Bobby's diagnosis, again, was schizophrenia of a mixed type, and it seems that once again, Bobby was diagnosed with the same illness, but this time they added the word serious. The state mental hospital sent an official letter to the courts and to the prosecuting attorney stating that Bobby Joe was not competent to stand trial, and they asked the court give them legal authority to hold him for treatment. The courts promptly replied and approved the request. This is not the end of the story of Bobby Joe Burns and his torment and delusional life, not by any means. There are little records of Bobby's stay in the hospital after the murder of his mother, but there were a few letters that he wrote to the courts and a note from the hospital stating that he had visited his son 2 straight days. On October 17th, his son had visited. He was described as his condition as morbid depression. He was wild, excited, fearful, and wouldn't talk. And then again, he was visited by his son on October the 18th. And it said, condition reversed, convulsive laughter, talkative, and very serious. And then they had made another note on the 3rd day. It did not say whether the son had visited, but it said, depression was followed by laughter. There had been no mention of his son before this time, nor Bobby's father or any of the other siblings, except for the brother that came to visit in the Fort Smith jail. But it was said that he had a sister in high school at the time of the murder. Fort Smith tried to put the Bobby Joe Burns story behind them, and most that lived here during that time still remembers it well. Most remember where they were, who they were with, or what they were doing at the time of the Burns murder. The officer that arrived on the scene when the head was discovered was never the same again. The officer had been known to walk the beat on Garrison and was very respected and very well liked by all. Reggie Moore, who worked at the archive, said that his grandmother worked next door to the Burns house when the murder occurred, and she could never return to work again. It was just so horrific for most of the people that worked or lived in the city. Bobby must have given thought to his situation at some point in time and realized he killed the one person that would rescue him from the state hospital. And without Edna to rescue him, as she always had, he needed to devise a plan to get out. He seemed to change that plan from time to time, as one of his first demands was to be electrocuted. In July of 1964, Bobby wrote to a judge and asked them to please change the murder conviction and sentence him to death. Bobby received no reply from that request. In July of 1968, Bobby composed another letter and sent it to the prosecuting attorney, Lyman Mickle's office, with the attention to Paul Wolfe. It read as follows. Dear sir, as you may know, I was in a vicarious mental state at the time that I killed my mother in 1958, and that killing came from God, or might have been said, right out of the wild blue yonder. The last time I was at the state hospital before the killing, I was released to my mother against medical advice and was taken. It was necessary for her to care for me, as my mental state was such that I could not care for myself. I do not recall being in jail after the murder, and I did not know the date or the day that I entered the hospital until much later. I mean, you know, at the time of the killing. I was aware of very little and remembered very little. Later, I went mad, and I suffered so hard from madness that I wrote the courts, as you recall, and requested that I be sent to the electric chair. I wanted to use this means to commit suicide. No charges were ever filed against me for killing until I requested them in July of 1964. Now I have recovered from my madness, and I feel so much better. Dr. R. E. Walters is trying hard to rehabilitate me. I work for the exit ward as a housekeeper, and Dr. Walters has told me that execution is a lie and that no one wants to try me. He's determined to help get me out. What I would like to ask you, gentlemen, is that you drop the charges I requested be filed against me so that I can leave the state hospital. Mr. Baker and Mr. Laster, the former is the director of the special education and the letters in this LPT here on the exit ward, want to send me back to school and so I can earn a degree, and the charges will first have to be dropped. Could you kindly drop them? I doubt that you want to deny that, as I am hopelessly insane at the time I killed my mother, and it was necessary to drop them at this point, as I am not a bad man. We are respectable people. My great-grandfather was a Baptist preacher in Logan County, and my grandfather was the clerk of Haskell County, Oklahoma. When we moved to Fort Smith in 1918, he paid a number of courtesy calls on your court. When the Cherokee Strip was opened, we were already there. We have many friends in Fort Smith, and once received a letter from Governor Francis Cherry, God bless him, telling me that no one has the right to mistreat me. So I urge you to drop the charges against me. Please heed Dr. Walter and myself. God bless you. I am very sincerely yours, Bobby Joe Burns. The next recorded letter that Bobby composed and mailed was to Judge Spencer Holland, dated August the 22nd, 1976. And it read, Dear Judge Holland, in June I wrote to Governor Pryor about getting something done about my case, and this month I received a reply from him. His administrative assistant can't do anything, and I need help to get a lawyer. Am I not entitled to a court-appointed attorney? I wish that you would appoint someone for me so that I can have someone to write to and what I must do. Blessing you, I am. Very truly yours, Bobby Joe Burns, State Hospital, RHB, Little Rock, Arkansas, 72203. Bobby had little hope of getting help from anyone outside since he didn't have his mother. But he was persistent, and he wrote another letter to Judge Holland in March of 78. I want to repent. I know right from wrong, and murder is a crime. I'm ready to stand trial and take the death penalty. This letter was really hard to read, and the last two are handwritten notes and are not typed as the first one. Bobby goes on to say in the last letter that he's ready to start World War III if something isn't done. He ends the letter with, Arrange for Sheriff Cawthron to come get me. Very truly yours, Bobby Joe Burns. Just ask Gary Monk Gilmore. The final note is still in existence and is handwritten in a notepad. It has a cartoonish-looking cat drawn at the bottom. It's in Bobby's handwriting, and it's addressed to the judge in Fort Smith, and it simply states, I'm going to kill you, Carter and Clinton. I demand a trial, Bobby Joe Burns. Bobby Joe Burns never received his requested trial. He never received his release or trip back to Fort Smith, and he passed away in the state mental hospital in October of 1982. And that's the story of Bobby Joe Burns in Fort Smith, Arkansas. For more of our crime cast, old and current, visit us at our website at www.remembereveryvictim.com or catch us on Facebook. You can find us under REVAMP, which stands for Remember Every Victim and Missing Person.